Welcome to Command Control Power, a weekly podcast hosted by three certified members of the Apple Consultants Network, drawing from nearly half a century of combined experience. We talk shop, interview vendors and colleagues, and share what we've learned while operating our technology consulting practices. This is Joe Sapinari of CIMAC, and my two co-hosts are Jerry Zygmunt of MacWorks and Sam Valencia of the HCS Technology Group. Listen live and join us in the chat at commandcontrolpower.com on the first Tuesday of every month. We also offer a weekly email newsletter, which includes show notes for each episode. Learn more at commandcontrolpower.com. And thanks for listening. Before we start the show, we want to tell you a little bit about an upcoming conference that we're very excited about, the ACES conference. This year, it's on May 9th and 10th in Baltimore, Maryland.
ACES is not like any other IT conference. We don't teach you how to debug your printer or work in terminal. ACES helps you grow your business. It doesn't matter whether you work in Mac or PC. It's platform agnostic.
I can speak from personal experience. ACES, year after year, has impacted me and my business tremendously.
Here's a quote from an attendee of ACES, Adam Rice. Adam says, "I like coming home and making more money. It was striking how much I learned that I was able to put to use immediately."
And best of all, for the third year in a row, we'll be broadcasting live at the ACES conference. May 9th and 10th, Baltimore. We want to see you there. Find out more by going to acesconf.com/CCP. Support ACES and support the show.
We'd like to welcome Michael Thompson, director of Origin 84, this week on Command Control Power. Michael, welcome.
Thanks for having me. Great to be with you.
Yeah, it's great to have you. You're based in Sydney, Australia. And so, you know, we'll just insert a couple of you living in the future jokes and things like that. But you are about 16 hours ahead of us here on the East Coast of the US. It's Thursday morning for you. It's Wednesday evening, early evening for us. So just to establish the timeline for the listeners. And you can let us know if Trump is still president as we progress through the show. That was your joke, Sam. I totally took your joke.
Well, I can tell you that the coffee today was just as good as the coffee yesterday.
Excellent. Just rattle off as many as you got. That's good. Get them all out of the way now, yeah. So thank you for the very kind gift at ACES last year. You were kind enough to, during the live show, if I remember correctly, and you gave us this really cool notebook, just a good old-fashioned notebook for people at home who think of that as like a, you know, device of some sort. It's paper-based, and it's got an awesome die-cut cover with your Origin 84 logo on the front, which is really, really cool. So thank you again for that.
That's my pleasure. Look, it's something you've been part of my journey. I think a lot of people come onto your show and speak about the place that you have in their business progression. You've been part of that for the last 4 years for me. And I just wanted to say thank you for all the effort that you do, because you create community, and community is really important. And especially at the moment is where, you know, seeing a lot of changes in, you know, like the ACN and how the, you know, managing Macs and things like that, we all need to get together and just discuss, you know, what we think and how we feel and just get that stuff out. So I really value what you've done, and that was just a small gesture.
We definitely thank you for that. But at the same time, it also showed us something important about what you told us at the conference, which was handing something physical or having something physical for a client, which can be extremely beneficial on that end. And I do love the book as well. I find myself actually using it where I hadn't used a notebook in quite a long time. It also indicated to me just how bad my handwriting was, but that's a whole other story.
Well, it's great feedback, because you give these things out and you just don't know whether they actually get used on a day-to-day basis. And so it's fantastic to hear that they are. Talking about the physical aspect, it's just that, you know, it really does come to the being memorable. You're talking to me nearly a year later about something that I gave you. And if I had met you and not done anything like that, we wouldn't be really that well connected.
Such a good point. And I think you've used this in regards to your clients as well. And I'm sure that's, you know, something you've practiced. You had made a plaque that you designed, right, that you would put up in a client location to remind them that you take care of the client. Was that the idea?
The plaque is something that it actually is a really old school thing. So I don't know how many of you have been into a data center that was built by IBM back in the 90s. What they do is they have the plaque and they reveal it, and obviously have someone of distinction come in and launch the data center, because back then they were, you know, really significant things for the community, I suppose, and for business. And I was in a data center a couple of years ago, and I just was waiting to be let in, and I read what was on the plaque, and it was, I can't remember the company, it was IBM or EDS, or one of these multinationals. It had a few words that were about, you know, we put this together and it's guaranteed till I think it was guaranteed for 25 years life or something like that. It had like a, you know, a commitment on it. And I really started to reflect on that. And I thought, well, IT is so transparent, especially when we're doing our jobs really well. How about what we do is we make our business more present with our clients when we're not there. So even though IT is working and they're not seeing us, we are still physically present. So that's where the idea came from.
You shared with us an image of what these plaques actually look like. If you give us permission, we'll put that in the show notes as well to share that with our listeners. You've sourced out a local vendor to make these for you at an affordable price. And how do you work the mechanics of presenting a plaque and what goes into the making of that?
I think that they probably look more substantial than they actually are. It's a bit of smoke and mirrors there. So the plaque is really just a graphic designer who is doing a photo quality print, and then we get frames from IKEA and we just mount them ourselves. There's an investment, but I think more to the point, it's the investment of thought that really carries the weight.
Well, that's powerful too, that you don't have to spend hundreds of dollars to have something that looks very, very impressive and can be easily mounted on a client wall and they can, something they can be proud of.
Yeah, it's interesting. Every client that receives one does put them somewhere prominent, and we are very proud of the fact that they are in prominent positions in their businesses.
The whole aspect of that is intriguing to me, as it always has been. But at the same time, does that mean that your client base is typically the business environment, or do you also have residential clients? What is your main focus, I guess, is my question.
Yeah, look, I jokingly say that my smallest client is my mother, and the largest client is one of the big four banks in Australia. And anywhere in between will help you. Some people fit better, and home users really just don't have a place in our business. That's just because we don't give them a good experience. We don't have the time or the patience for sitting there and rifling through iPhoto and Mobile Me accounts and all those other things that are, you know, typical home user problems. We need to work to our strengths to support our client base, and that's really starting to show now with all of the automation that we push across of our sort of managed clients. To answer your question, no, we don't really support anyone on a home basis unless they've got a home attached to an executive of a business, which I think is similar to probably what you do as well.
Yeah, and I would imagine having the plaque next to all the family photos in a residential client doesn't exactly work, so stick to more of the businesses, right?
Origin 84, I can give you a bit of a background about myself and the business. So I started working with Apple after never having used a computer before back in 2003. I studied an architecture degree. Through that, did have some Mac exposure just using the tools of the day, such as Vectorworks and so forth. But I actually spent a year at the end of that degree traveling, went overseas. I ended up in Montana actually as a snowboard instructor and came back after being a ski bum without a job and without any sort of aspiration to go back into architecture. And it was at that time that a former principal of our school where I was studying had left, and he had bought into a local Apple. They were called back then Apple Centers. So they were the precursor to the Apple Store, privately owned franchise. I got offered some hours there. And at that time, didn't know very much about the technology at all, but I did know about how to communicate well and so forth. So the thing that got me across the line with the technology was the fact that the pricing and the product matrix is very, very simple and is still that way today, which is good quality, mid quality, low quality in terms of performance, and then good, better, best when it comes to spec. I really just had to learn how to spec the right device for the right person, and that was really launched my sales career with the Apple product. After that, we moved through to opening a couple more of those stores, and there was a point in time where it was clear that people weren't actually being supported properly. And so I started supporting people at home on the weekends and made a bit of extra cash. But over the time, we found that there was a real need. And this was, when I say we, I mean some of the people I was working with in these organizations who just kind of found that the culture didn't fit. So adding services on as an afterthought were just really not what it was about. And so it was about 2007, just before the global financial crisis, where I left and started to work for a managed services provider, or what we would have called them back then. That was a real revelation to me to work just supporting a Mac rather than selling them. I'm not a technical person, but I have to call that out now. And I listen to your podcast and I listen to all the things that you do and all of the command line stuff and all of the tricks that you pull. I couldn't do any of it. So what I've learned is I know what I don't know, and I employ and embrace the people that do. And so that's been key to our success so far. The GFC was very unkind in Australia to the advertising and marketing sector. I don't know what it was like over there. How many of you were in business at that time?
2008, I think you're referring to the financial crisis.
2008, yeah.
I was in business, and I think all three of us were. I don't know how it affected you guys, but for me, you know, I certainly noticed a downtick in the financial sector among my clients. And I even had some people give me a little bit of flack over the fact that I sort of continued to progress through my, you know, business. I even raised my rates kind of in the midst of that. I had some clients say businesses are closing right and left and lines around the corner, you know, to get gas. I mean, he was painting a really different picture than reality, but anyway, he was making a point, and here you are raising your rate, ! That was like one or two people, but for the most part, the benefit of working with a wide spectrum of clients, it didn't affect everybody quite to the same degree. So I didn't notice a huge downturn. I was able to kind of just ride that out. But I imagine, you know, if you focus more on business exclusively, you know, that might have been more of a focused kind of effect. But I'm curious, from Sam and Jerry, how did you guys weather that storm?
Well, I certainly didn't raise my rates like you, Joe. That's just, you know, I did see a bit of a pullback on projects and things along those lines, where we didn't have any MSP model at the time. So we were just contract based. But anything that we wanted to do that might run out the contract hours or require them to take out another contract was considered just something they should put the brakes on and wait. So we did have a period of time where we were still making our money, but we weren't getting those pushes for big projects like migrations and servers and all that other stuff that would have normally come along.
Michael, focusing on your business, one of the things that Joe and I were discussing prior to the show starting was we were really surprised at some of the requirements put on consultants in Australia versus the United States. Can you talk a little bit about that and how much competition you actually have in the area and what that landscape looks like for you?
The first thing that we have in Australia is a small market, and that means that there's a small talent pool, and previously, until the last, you know, 5 years, it was also a small user base to actually support. Primarily, the client bases would be in the education sector, they'd be in the creative industries, and so people were quite narrow in where they were looking to support in terms of finding new clients and so forth. In terms of requirements that we have down here in Australia, we're very heavily regulated in Australia. That's a good thing for many reasons. You know, regulation protects both parties in any kind of transaction. So, you know, we have heavy insurance costs, and a lot of our time is spent in making sure that at the beginning of a relationship that we set things up well. So I know you've had some guests on talking about contracts and so forth. We really want to get that conversation about contracts out of the way in the first meeting, even if it's an introductory meeting, because clients need to know that there is going to be paperwork, there is going to be a commitment from both sides, and we do have to have that done before we touch anything, because, you know, the liability is huge. As we're probably not as litigious as the Americans, but certainly reputationally, and also as soon as you're put into any kind of legal process here, it's a bit of a small town syndrome. You will get put up the flagpole, you will be put into the newspaper, and you don't want to be in that sort of situation.
Wow. So I would imagine that's one of the first things you did when you started your business was get lawyered up and got contracted up.
Yeah, look, I can talk to you about that briefly. I think that what we've done is a really, you know, I'd like to say it's an elegant way of doing it. When we start working with a client, it doesn't matter who the client is, we have the initial meeting, and following that meeting, we send them a standard form contract. Now, that contract basically says, you know, this is who we are, this is who you are, this is what we represent as Origin E4. And then it goes through things like managing data, we won't steal your intelligence, and then on the other side of that, you won't steal Origin 84 staff. You know, once those kind of terms are set, we ask for a prepayment of 10 hours. And what I do that for is to simply engage the accounts department to get that first payment out. Now, I find that it's really hard sometimes to get payments out of companies because they want to dictate their terms to you rather than you being able to dictate your terms to them. So by going through that process of saying, look, we want 10 hours of prepaid support to begin with, the mechanisms of finding out who's in accounts, who's the CFO, whoever you need to deal with to get the money out, we get that done at the front end. And that means the next time we have to invoice them, we don't get a longer lag for payment. That doesn't include any support level agreement or anything like that. That's just basically the frame of operation to start with.
That's a great idea. Just jumpstart accounting rather than 30 days elapse or 15 days elapse, whatever your terms are. We see this all the time. We're waiting for the financial department. And, oh, you know, we need your tax ID. And you wait and wait. They can certainly extend out the payment times with just bureaucracy.
Right. And meanwhile, you've done all the work, and it may take weeks before the invoice actually lands in the right person's inbox if you haven't done the legwork up front. So that's a really, really useful point for listeners.
It's a great tip.
And we hold those 10 hours of prepaid support, and we will use them in the first period of time until such time as a contract is in place. But those 10 hours kind of end up just sitting on a balance ledger, and we don't dip into them. And it's almost like in the event that the last invoice didn't get paid, we'll just absorb that 10 hours of credit and just call it a day. Hmm. So we're like managing our own risk at that point.
Right. You kind of start off with the whole balance in your favor. That's really a fantastic position to be in. And then I was wondering if it sounds like you don't necessarily use it for this purpose, but would you put those hours toward any kind of discovery process, to engage with that client further?
Yes, that's kind of the idea, because, when you walk in cold to a client, as you're not going to know the nuances of the business, and there's no way that you can say, okay, out of that first meeting that you'll be able to get a contract price or anything like that. So, yeah, we do spend 10 hours engaging with stakeholders, doing exploratory. If we are going to do a full audit and there's no commitment yet from the client, we will charge them a separate fee to do the audit and discovery. Mm-hmm. I think that's, again, just goes to show that this is a valuable thing that you're having us do rather than just being something that we're adding in no value to try and win your business.
It's a good point. A lot of value comes out of that, even if they don't move forward with a full contract or even choose to engage you further. It's just that they've had their systems looked at by a professional, and you've made your professional recommendations, or at least recapped it in some way that may actually be actionable, depending on how you present that to them. There is a lot of value there, and it's surprising sometimes how much we go through with, could be anything from a half hour phone call to hours on site sometimes, where may not even ultimately be billable, and it really should be.
We have a very different view, I think, to some of the vendors out there in the marketplace, where we want the business to be the key holder to their own business. We don't want to hold a business over the barrel because we're the IT people and we hold those keys. So I've worked really hard in the last 2.5 years as I've gone from being a sole trader doing this myself, where all of the information resided in my head and I was doing what most people did, which is you resell licensing subscription to Adobe and all those other things to make a little bit of margin along the line. There was a point just before I started taking on employees where I went through a bit of a personal issue and I lost focus for a little while, and I realized that through that, I didn't invoice some Adobe licensing. Now, as Adobe licensing, when you're doing it, it's expensive licensing. It's hundreds of dollars per license per month. I probably lost $1,500 to $2,000 in that little lapse. And you get to a point where you feel like you can't go back to the client and ask for that money because time has passed, and sort of conflicted about what you should do. Is it ethical to go back and whatever else? But at the end of the day, I decided to write it off. But the lesson I learned was I was actually only making like $25 per license. So I looked back over all of the years that I've been reselling Adobe products. I hadn't been making very much money. I'd been wearing a lot of that cost. And at the end of the day, I decided that this is the reason why I'm going to give everything back to the client. So our process is that the client owns all of their subscriptions. We might manage them, but they're registered in their domain with one of their people as the primary contact. They pay the bill with their credit card. And that has worked really, really well. What we now do is we just charge them a management fee for software subscriptions. And so that was with a margin I was making before is now just a fee. And so that's been a way to reduce more liability and cash flow that was going to the 30 days terms before, where we didn't have it in our business, it was in their business. So that's just one thing I can call out as a way to assist when it comes to those kind of things, when it comes to cash flow as well.
Well, it's another great example. I'm noticing a pattern here. It's all about shifting the risk-reward balance more in your favor. Not necessarily putting the client in a worse position, but it's just basically making it more equitable. You're getting paid to manage the the licensing, you're getting paid to manage the client relationship. That's what you specialize in. They bear the burden of actually keeping the credit card up to date when they get the reminder to update their subscription information or whatever the case may be. And you may be giving them reminders about that too. But the point is that they have the direct relationship with the vendor. So there's never a time where you're at risk because they go out of business and now you've paid for 3 extra months of subscription that you'll never see the money for again.
To the conversation topic that you picked up on last year now about offboarding clients, I had a spectacular experience recently where a traditional PC managed services provider decided to work with one of our clients because of a personal relationship with the client and the owner of that business. And so the business just was removed from our responsibility to theirs. In that process, they were going to move them to cloud services, to Dropbox and so forth for this PR and advertising company. And that was fine. At the end of the day, that's the business's decision to do so. But what we did find that this method allowed us to simply ease out of that relationship without any reason to go back for the next 2 months after we're not supporting them to go, oh, okay, by the way, this subscription's with us. We need to transfer it to your new vendor. It was literally, here it is. You should change these passwords because we currently have them. Here's your documentation. Thanks. And so I'm not saying that you set things up to lose clients, but I'm certainly saying that it does give the client a sense of control when you say to them, look, we're doing this, so in the event that something does go wrong with our business or the relationship between the two companies doesn't continue, you're very simply able to go to the next person.
I mean, that's something that I try to aspire to, the principles that you just laid out too. And in the insurance business, they talk about reducing your exposure, and this certainly does. And it gives the client kind of a good feeling that if in fact the relationship for whatever reason might turn, that it's not this walled garden that you've prepared for them. And there's all these little pieces of connective tissue and twines of thread that you have to unravel and connect to the next guy. And I just support that methodology completely.
The alternative is calling it job security for yourself. When the system is so complex and everything is connected to your company in some way, that the client feels like a sense of disempowerment where they don't want to get on your bad side because their business might be in jeopardy. What a bad feeling, you know, who wants to be kind of part of that relationship? But it's just funny that some people call it like unironically job security, that they hold the keys to the kingdom. It sounds like you've got the exact polar opposite approach. And yeah, I agree with Jerry. I think that's something to aspire to for sure.
Yeah, I wouldn't always position it with the client. It is about the end. When we discuss it, we want to actually get them to have in some ownership over this. So it's all about that we're doing IT for you together with you rather than we're doing IT for you. So when we lose track of that fact, and from a point of view internally from our team, when we think that we do it all and they don't know anything, or the alternative is the company sees us as us doing all and they don't have any visibility or control, I think that ends up into the space that you're talking about. So we really try and talk about this is us working with you and you have some ownership and you need to come to the table regularly to keep talking to us. And that communication channel, this gives us a reason to talk about things, you know, it not just a quarterly meeting or whatever else. It gives us the ability to have another contact point when the credit card does expire.
What are some of the concerns you have in doing business? It seems like you've basically covered so many bases. I can't imagine there are a lot of edge cases that come up where, like in my business, I might randomly hear from a client who doesn't call me on a regular basis and we don't have any sort of like ongoing relationship, pre-MSP clients basically, where they've suddenly migrated their website, say, and you know the person that they engaged with to do that screwed up the DNS and now they can't get email, falls in my lap, and I could certainly say, hey, you know, we have no ongoing relationship and I can't help you right now. But of course, we always try and help and we make it right and we charge accordingly. But I'm just curious if you still find any pitfalls. I imagine not along those lines usually, because you do have this more ongoing open communication with your clients across the board, it sounds like, or ideally. Are there any sort of pitfalls in your business listeners who are at a certain level might want to be aware of?
2.5 years ago, I went from being a sole trader to having employees. And it was at that point where I had a day job and was consulting when I had time and at night. Had a situation there where you would kind of just take everything you could get your hands on because you're hungry for it. And I'm sure that this is a common thread when people are starting out, where you just go, yeah, yes, that's money. I'll take it. what happened is when I employed our senior engineer, Jonathan, as Origin 84 became a company, it was clear very, very quickly where he said to me, I don't want to be going on site to restart printers. That's just not what I want to be doing in this job. And you know what? That stuck with me very much because we need to get to a situation where the printer is managed by us. And so we don't have to worry about going on site to fix it. Now, what that does do in terms of the business is that we don't win a lot of business. So we will go up against people who are contacting us. So a client contacts us and they'll be going to us and another vendor. Another vendor will do that sort of work at the beginning, like it's on fire, come and fix it. And at the beginning we say, well, look, we'll come and fix it, but you have to pay for the 10 hours of support. And so I think that it was a long time ago, Lewis Giraldo was on the show and he was saying, look, my on-site fees are like a one-day minimum. And I didn't think that I had the bravado to go that far. But certainly by saying, look, we'll fix the problem, we'll come in, but this is only the first stop on a longer term. That's the way that we sort of handle those interactions. Does that answer your question?
Sense. Absolutely. Yeah. I think that, you know, it makes sense to expect something in return, like a longer term relationship, a little bit more engagement on the client side. It helps you filter out the type of client that would just call you when things are on fire and expect, you know, immediate service and only on their terms. And so if you just set that right up front, let them know what your expectations are for the way you work. It does filter out a lot of business, but of course, that's also, as you're describing, you know, maybe to your detriment in the sense of winning fewer clients. But then again, the ones you have probably are of a higher quality as far as the consulting relationship goes.
Yeah, and we don't have a chart of fees. And so that really spooks some people. They don't know what our hourly rate will be or what the cost, you know, will be per user. And that's fine because the model that we have is we're going to be doing things that really don't fit into a per user or to a, you know, hourly fee kind of scenario. So, you know, there are three engineers in our teams. We've got Jonathan, Miro, and Mario, you know, very good engineers. They don't have any financial conversation with an end client at all. So our directive to those team members are you respond to tickets, you respond to problems, and I'll monitor what's going on when it comes to how many hours you're spending and what the financial implication is to the client. But when the client calls and the client's got a problem, just work on it. And so I think that has given them the ability to focus on providing the best solutions and answers to problems. And then sometimes it's come back to haunt me because I've kind of not monitored it well enough. But at the same time, the client that is having the problem, the person the engineer talks to is not the person that's financially responsible. So, you know, for us to go through and get financial approval for all of these interactions between team member on Origin 84 side and team member on client side, if we had to get approvals for all that stuff, it's just too much paperwork and just time consuming. So I'm putting a bit of trust in the relationship there. Trust is a huge word in our organization. So we're trusting the client isn't going to abuse what we're offering them, but at the same time, the client has to trust that we're there when they need us.
Without exposing your secret formula or giving it away, how do you come up with a calculation of what is fair and equitable to charge the client? I mean, you must probably have some sort of a sliding scale depending on how many hours the client will require. What are some of the things that you look for in coming up with a number?
So we can all do this together, right? So you take your index finger and you lick it and then you raise it in the air and you take a guess.
Right.
And no, it's not really like that at all. We've all been around a while, right? So there's a certain dollar value applied to certain numbers of users, and there's flex points when you go through, you know, there's 5 and 10, and then, you know, 10 to 20, like you can probably carry from 10 to 20, and then from 20 plus to 50. Like, you know, you kind of know, like, and then there's the tech
sure.
stack and how much the tech stack is manageable, how much is old, and so forth. So when we go through the process, really what we're looking for is not how much we want to get out of the client, is how much value do we think the client's going to get. And that's a two-way conversation. So one of the conversations that we have early on when we're negotiating is, so how much is your current IT budget? And then how much is that current IT budget going towards maintaining and supporting it? And so by getting the client to do a little bit of research, look back into their previous arrangements and come back to us with a number, you're kind of doing some of the guesswork by getting the information in fact. So, you know, for example, I had a client recently, they're a multinational agency who are being looked after by a local company who are nerds to you kind of thing, you know, like nameless, faceless, and you know who they are. We bump into their work all the time. The client said, oh, look, you know, we're paying $1,800 a month, and that's how much the contract fee is. And I said, okay. And she said, look, we've been having heaps of problems. What is the issue here? And I said, well, what are you finding are the problems? And she said, oh, we just don't see them and they're not responsive. And, you know, the classic kind of situation where, you know, they've clearly gotten busy and the focus on the client wasn't right. And in the end, I said, look, I think it's really coming down to the fact that they probably don't feel that they're getting enough money from you to come and service you in a better way. And whether that's because they feel that the calls that they're doing are, you know, always chasing their tail because they don't have systems in place or so forth, I said, realistically, you're probably not paying enough for the services. And so we started that conversation, and ultimately the client will probably pay double what they used to pay for, you know, support fees, because what they were asking for was what their real world looked like is they wanted to have twice as much visibility with people on site. So at that point, you know, I had a number, they wanted to see twice as much. That's a very good, you know, way of getting a number to start negotiating on.
You're relying a little bit on client honesty, of course, to come back at you. Some clients don't even consider a tech budget. And that's actually a very good exercise for them as well, to just go back and look at what their costs are. I have to ask you this one question before we go any further. It was a pleasure to meet you when we were at ACES and struck everybody here tonight. And also, when we met you at ACES, I know others commented, you've got a very keen business acumen. I have to ask, were your parents in business, or did you have a mentor that you worked with early on? Because you have just a very good business sense.
Look, I think that there have been a lot of influences along the way. I'd like to thank a lot of people for spending time with me when I was growing up. And one of the jobs that I got the most out of was working as a construction laborer. And it was a builder and myself as his laborer. And we just drove around doing, you know, renovations and fixes and so forth. And it was one of those times where I was being quite impressed upon by a guy called Jerry, by the way, who had a good sense of, look, you know, if I'm going to, and building is very different to IT in terms of what you need to get a job done too. And I think that this is where it kind of highlights to us is we do a lot with not a lot of overhead. So really it's just a laptop and your intellectual property that's getting most of these jobs done. He used to explain to me that, you know, I've got to have a pickup truck, I've got to have a compressor, a nail gun, a saw, all of these things. And he said, so all of that is my costs. And then I've got to like have my time, and I've got to have your time covered, and then I have to make profit. And I think that the thing at that point I learned was that you have to factor profit in first. Now, all of the people that we bump into who become thought leaders on these sort of things, and we go back to ACES, and Mike McAllowitz was one of those, profit first. And we're doing this to, you know, support our families and, you know, our personal ambitions. We're not doing this to be charity to our clients. Going through that process of putting the profit in first and then working out your costs beyond that to get your pricing is exactly the way that I still do things today.
That's a really interesting approach. Profit first and then factor in all your costs rather than looking at all the costs and then thinking about what do you want to add on top of that or what's reasonable, or, you know, there's other limiting factors there that may sort of hamstring the whole process. So yeah, looking at profit first that sounds like a really powerful approach. Just circling back to the coming up with, I guess, what some consultants call the magic number, right? Where, you know, you're just charging them X amount per month, and behind the scenes, you've factored in the number of users and the number of hours and the expectations and things like that. How forthcoming are clients with sharing their tech budget? You know, Jerry mentioned their honesty obviously is key. I just wonder, you know, how does that conversation proceed? Are some clients just turned off by the very concept of, you know, you tell me first what you're paying and then I'll tell you what I'm charging? How does that go?
The analogy I have here is a little bit like when you go to your GP or your doctor and he asks you whether you're a drinker, a smoker, whether you're taking drugs, you're exercising. You can lie at that point and say that you exercise every day, that you don't drink and you don't smoke, but they will do the tests and they will show that this is actually not the truth. And so the onus on the client when we are in these meetings is about honesty and about transparency and about we can't help you unless you are very, very honest with us at the front end. And so this is a trusted relationship. We are running these companies, and I don't say that we're running the business decisions behind these companies, but on a day-to-day basis, if we don't turn up because we choose to just not turn up anymore, these businesses stop. And so we try and impress onto the client exactly what it is that your IT guy is actually doing for your business. And it only takes an office of 100 users to have an outage for 15 minutes before they realize that actually IT is really important and we should probably value it a bit more. So to your point about whether they give me the right or the wrong, we know what it would actually cost to do it right. And so if they come back and say that they're getting their IT done for half the price that we would charge and that's all they want to pay, then the conversation for us would be over. We would refer them to somebody else who we know would probably be willing to pay to take that amount of money for that job. And I would be happy to say that the quality wouldn't be as good.
I got to get Michael to do all my deals.
Yeah, exactly. Can you do all our negotiations here?
I wouldn't mind doing it. I think that there's also a little bit of international flavor. You know, you can sure. woo some people by having an Australian do the deal.
Exactly. Exactly.
There's another thing I'll add to this, and it's about the word is margin. There's a guy who runs the blog called The Sweet Setup. His name is Sean Blanc. Mm-hmm. He also does a course called The Focus Course. And I encourage people to have a bit of a look at what he has to say, because he does a little bit about a thing called margin. Now, when I was listening to him talking about this, I realized that, you know, margin, what he was talking about was finding space to do your best creative work. And that's great because it works for his industry. But what I'm talking about when now I think about margin, it's like it's allowing my team to do their best work. And to make that happen, they need margin in their day. And to give them margin in the day, we have to make profit margin off our clients. And so when it comes to those magic numbers about, you know, scaling out from a single user price to 20 users and saying, well, that's our magic number, we need to also remember that we need to be paying for professional development. We need to be investing back in tools and things that we think will go well and that don't. You know, we're in a good example internally here is we, at the end of last year, signed up to use Autotask as our PSA. Before that, we didn't actually use a PSA. We used, you know, a complement of tools linked by API. If I didn't have margin in the resourcing internally to help me go through that process of building it out and testing it, we wouldn't be able to explore that in a robust way. We would have just gone, okay, we've got to go with this now. I've paid the thousands of dollars to get into this system and we're just going to have to run with it. What's actually occurred, because we sort of have that time, we've actually decided that it's not the right thing for us. We've gone back to Autotask and said, no thanks, because we've actually spent the time that we have allocated to that to do the robust testing. So one thing I really want to encourage is, you know, people to work out how to give themselves that space. You know, it's that personal margin for their families. It's the margin to work with a client not under pressure. So this is just hanging out with your client. And, you know, when it comes to your engineers and team members, technically giving them the space to go and actually test things and break things and not be under the pressure of going, I've got to get to the next on-site.
Yeah, that's great advice.
I need margin in my day. That sounds luxurious at this point, but I completely see the benefit. I mean, the kind of day where we have much better flow and a little bit of space, you know, or margin in between appointments tends to just yield much higher quality work for every client. And I think that the value proposition can really be made to the client that charging you a little bit more so that we have a little bit more time and the luxury of that margin in the day to do better work, you know, not only for this client, but for all of our clients. The end result is everybody's happier. Consultants are less stressed and therefore they are doing better work. We're giving the client better value, not only in better quality work, but in determining some of those things that we might not otherwise see where we can advise the client to maybe help them save a lot of money, be in the right position to capitalize on a new trend or whatever other advice, you know, we can give them thanks to that ability just to kind of like think through how we can better serve them. So building that into the profit part and allowing for room in the day to do better work, I mean, that's a really great starting point. I kind of wish I had this conversation about 15 years ago. Would be a different place that I'm in, but I can move things in that direction. And that's, you give me an assignment here with the Sean Blanc Focus Course. That's on my list.
all degrees of change. There is no one way that I can walk into any situation and go, look, you know, do it like this, turn it 180 degrees and you'll get there. Like, I encourage people to look at problems from the opposite perspective at a 180 degree angle, because that will give you insight, but you can't then just simply go, okay, well, I'm all into this way of doing things today. You have to slowly get there, and you will over time get there, and it will reveal to you that there was a point where that started, and you can be very, very proud of the work that you've done incrementally. If you go to any gym, right, there's no shortcut to getting fit. So you have to just put in the hard yards, and it's slow burn. You'll get there if you focus on it. And, you know, what one thing that this has done from our point of view is we actually don't have a company slogan or anything like that. But internally, I talk very much about the fact that we don't like saying sorry. So our business doesn't like to be apologetic. And I've found that as we've built in more time, we make less mistakes. And ultimately, as the owner of the business, I'm in less meetings where I have to apologize to a client because something's gone wrong. I don't really want to say sorry. I don't like apologizing. I'm kind of a bit proud. And ultimately, I've had to do it a couple of times because we have made the mistake. But the goal is in our business, so to do things right so we don't have to say sorry.
That's a great approach as well. Great thing to try to have in the back of your mind. Like, if you don't make the mistake in the first place, you won't be in that position where you're having to apologize. And in order to enable not making a mistake, you really do have to have that little bit of extra time. That's part of the way you design the value proposition, the rate structure, building that in from the front. You know, you may have a harder time landing clients. You know, you won't have maybe as many clients, but the ones you do have will get that, and you'll be able to make that case and build the practice from there. So I think that's a really, really great approach. As we kind of wind down the conversation, we heard a little bit about your origin, and I read a little bit about the origin of your Origin 84 name. I surprised that I didn't realize and figure it out on my own, but it refers to 1984, the year the Mac was introduced. Do you want to talk a little bit more about the inspiration going back to that original Mac keynote?
Origin 84 was a name that came up after doing some brainstorming, and I ended up looking at YouTube actually at the time, and the 1984 Super Bowl ad was the thing that kind of struck me. You know, this was a big deal. Apple put a real line in the sand there in that 1984 and said, we're starting something big. And they did, and it is still going 35 years later, which is fantastic. So that's kind of where that came from. Our brand is a bit irreverent. It's not very tech focused in terms of what you see on the website and when we're, you know, out there in the marketplace. We really do want to talk about problem solving and what technology should look like and relationships. At the end of the day, it doesn't really matter what technology you have. If you support it in the right way, you're going to get a good result for your business. And so we're really trying to push that. And, you know, interestingly enough, Origin 84 we lead with Apple. We support a lot of PC, and that's not to say that it's a, you know, a massive percentage, but certainly if you came along and you're a Windows-based customer and you're willing to take the Apple type of experience on, where you get high touch and good value from, you know, your engineers, we'll just take them on as well. So Origin 84 is kind of just the vessel, and, you know, technology is going to change in the future what we do, especially as we move away from Mac OS to Mac iOS and so forth. So we don't know what the future looks like. So that's kind of where we're at with the brand.
Well, I guess your slogan, or maybe it's an unofficial slogan I found on the website, but it kind of says it all. I mean, you do mention Macs, but the idea of offering advice and counsel, your slogan goes, whip smart ideas and advice for businesses who earn a living with their Macs. And I think it just kind of encompasses everything we've talked about. You know, it's not about the break fix model. It's not about servicing technology and, you know, upgrading things and updating things and, you know, all these little tasks that we may do in the course of offering our services. But your service is offering ideas and advice for businesses. And these businesses largely happen to earn a living with their Macs. But it sounds like, you know, you go well beyond the basic break-fix model. So it sounds like you've got a great business there. And I think listeners can really learn a lot from the way you've structured it.
I have a lot of fun. You know, it's really important to be able to, you know, enjoy what I do as well as the technical team enjoy what they do. It's given me a lot of opportunity working in the Apple space. I met you at ACES. I'm coming across to America in a couple of weeks' time to join part of the ACN roadshow to see what's going on over there in the ACN space and catch up with some other people who I've met along the way. And, you know, I've been lucky enough to meet great people in the community, such as Alan Hancock and Brian Best, Joel Rennick, you know, all of these guys who have just really done a lot of cool things in this community. And I'm privileged to be able to have a business that allows me to do that.
Can we just focus on that for one moment, Michael, about some of the differences between just being an ACN in Australia versus the United States? I know you've been here a number of times and you talked to a number of people who practice their craft here. One of the things, for instance, you're required to have two certified consultants on site to call yourself an ACN. Could you speak to that a little bit?
The ACN for me is really important. It's important because, you know, if we didn't have an ACN in terms of Apple engineers wouldn't have anything to sort of pin their hat on as this is what I do and this is how I, you know, identify myself. And as an ACN partner, Origin 84, we were not really quick to join the bandwagon. We actually were going quite well without being on the ACN. We were picking up new business and so forth. But there was a point where I was picking up business from clients who were not being looked after well by ACN partners. And that kind of was a bit of a big red flag for me about whether we wanted to affiliate. So what we did at the time is we spoke to the Apple delegate out here in Australia who looks after the ACN and had a frank conversation about, you know, what it was that there was value and how it was changing in terms of what you needed to be to get on board. At the time, they said, look, there is change underway. And the change that's been underway in Australia has been that Apple has become much more proactive in running training, dialogue between our technical team and the Apple consultant's technical lead has improved. And so the technical side of things, we're getting a strong relationship forming there. At the same time, when I speak to, we have two other things which I should mention. We don't pay to be on the ACN. So we just affiliate and we need to have a physical location and two certified members to be on the ACN. I think it's different for you over there where you can be a sole operator. You don't necessarily need to have a physical shopfront location. But I think we're seeing that Apple have taken a bit of a focus and used maybe Australia as a bit of a test market to try and see what works and what doesn't. And I know that there's been a lot more noise in the last few months in the US from what I can pick up about certifications, about consultation with the ACN partners. That's something that I think that, you know, you have an opportunity now to really get involved and form out what the ACN of the future will look like. Because realistically, Apple have probably let it go a little bit too long without too much love. We don't have an ACN council here. And I'm sure that there are parallel conversations between what happens between the ACN council and what the ACN councillors talk about outside of the Apple view. So I'm coming across to Austin to the roadshow that Apple are putting on for the Apple consultants there, just to get a bit of an idea of what the market's looking like so we can just be ahead of the game. And what I really do encourage you all to do is if you are part of the ACN and you haven't submitted your form for your feedback, please do, because we don't have the privilege of that feedback form in Australia. And so it's really important that that feedback gets back to Apple, because it's going to inform our future over here as much as your future there.
Well, I certainly know who I would elect or nominate to be on the ACN Advisory Council in Australia. If Apple ACN ever chooses to create one, that would be you, Michael Thompson, Director of Origin 84. As we wind down, I just want to thank you again so much for joining us and sharing tons of awesome information. Really being sincere, I feel like I've learned a lot in how to position things with clients, how to structure our rates and our value proposition, and how to make the case to clients. And that's just really invaluable. So thank you so much for joining us. Really appreciate it.
That's fine. Thanks for having me. And look, I'm contactable. So you can find me on the MacAdmin Slack, or you can contact us through the Origin 84 website. Happy to have a conversation. I love talking about this stuff. It's probably my indulgence.
Well, the pleasure is ours. Thank you again. And yeah, speaking of community, we've mentioned community a couple times tonight. And the Mac Admin Slack is indeed a great community. And I've seen you active there on the ACN channel. Yeah, I would encourage listeners to check that out if they haven't yet. Thank you again, Michael, for joining us. Really appreciate it.
Thanks, Lex. Speak again soon. I think I've said this before in the Slack. My kids are forced to listen to Command Control Power in the car. And so they, you know, they got to my oldest is 11 now, and they're seven, you know, that one's 9 and then 7. They said, "Oh, do we have to listen to these three Americans, Dad? Do we just have to do it?" This morning, as we were bundling them out of the house so the house could be quiet so I could have this call, I said, "Oh, I'm having a web conference." And they said, "Oh, Dad, another one, yes." And I said, "I'm talking to those three Americans, and so you can listen to me in the car now too."
Nice.
So So it's great to be able to kind of go, you know what, you sat through that for 200 and something episodes, and now you're going to get to hear me.
Can we stop listening now, Dad, finally, after hearing you appear? That's awesome. They're going to think you're famous now at this point.
You can be big on the internet for lots of reasons. it's probably not going to be the reason that they're going to tell their friends, though.
Michael, one more thing before we start. Are you traveling in a fried out combi? I just need to know.
Traveling in a fried out combi. On a hippie trailhead full of zombies.
Not at the moment.
Okay. All right.
I used to.
Is anybody getting the reference at all?
Not me.
I know what that means, but it must be from something. I don't know what that's from.
This must have been back in the 80s, you know, when MTV first became popular. Not that many groups that actually had videos ready to go. And there was one Australian group that got lots of airplay here in the U.S. called Men at Work. They have a song called The Land Down Under, and that's one of the lines. All right, this is where I'm going to probably have to insert the laugh track again, Joe. I'm thinking.
Yeah, I guess so. At least you have it handy from the live show.